Hello everyone, and welcome to a Scottish flavoured edition of the Rambling Through Albion podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Annette.
We're going to tell you about our visit to one of London's newest architectural landmarks, but our focus this week is on the Scottish poet and lyricist Robert Burns, hence the bagpipes. We attended a Burns supper on Saturday evening, and we'll use that as a base from which to explore the man's life and times.
I would guess that most Korean people don't know much about Robert Burns.
Yeah, I'm fairly ignorant myself, despite the fact that I lived in Scotland for 4 years. But the supper that we attended in his honour, albeit in central London rather than in his homeland, has motivated me to learn more. As we'll see, Burns was quite a character and is probably as highly regarded as any historical figure to have hailed from Scotland.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. Where and when was Burns born?
Robert, or Rabbi Burns, was born in Alloway, a village a couple of miles from Ayr in southern Scotland, on the 25th of January 1759. He was the eldest of seven children, and although his father had him working on the farm from what we certainly nowadays would consider a very early age, his education was also taken care of. His father taught the children reading, writing, geography, history and arithmetic, and young Rabbi's learning was further supplemented by additional tuition in Latin and French.
So Scotland's most loved poet came from humble beginnings.
Well, that's certainly the image that was built up around him, especially just after his death. He was known in the Edinburgh literary circles as the heaven-taught ploughman. But the fact is that despite his lack of formal education, the level of learning he did receive was probably much greater than that of his peers. Still, by his mid-teens, it did look like he'd work out his days on the farm, despite the hardships that that brought. But after being offered a job in Jamaica in the mid-1780s, which he couldn't take up immediately because he couldn't afford the boat fare, Burns was encouraged to publish his poetry in order to raise the necessary funds. His first volume of poetry, entitled Poems, Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect, was issued in late July 1786. This was enthusiastically received by the critics in Edinburgh, and by September, Burns had been invited to the bright lights of the capital, having received word that a second extended volume of his work would be well received in the city.
Was it difficult for the farmer to adapt to life in Edinburgh?
He seemed to enjoy it greatly, and by all accounts carried himself well in company that he maybe hadn't been used to back in Ayrshire. Although he stayed in Edinburgh for less than a year, he managed to produce that second volume of work, for which he was handsomely paid, and he made a number of friends, not to mention plenty of female companionship, which was a feature throughout his life and the inspiration for many of his works. Burns spent the money from the rights to his work on a series of tours throughout Scotland and even across the north of England. Essentially, between May and September 1787, Burns travelled far and wide, from Dumfries in southwest Scotland to Aberdeen in the far northeast and across to the West Highlands. It was an opportunity for him to gain further inspiration and to promote himself and his work to potential buyers. Do check out the University of Glasgow's interactive map, produced in collaboration with the National Library of Scotland, of Burns's Highland tour. You can see the route that he followed and read his thoughts on the places he visited. It's very informative indeed.
Did Burns go back to Edinburgh when he finished touring?
He didn't actually. He headed back home and began working on the farm once more. Again, success in that field, if you'll pardon the pun, was hard to come by, and he eventually took up a job as a government official, working in customs and excise. It's quite hard to believe, actually. Burns was still very young and a talented man. He'd moved in exalted circles and was feted around the country, and here he was, working on a farm and then as a tax collector. He did still continue to churn out a wealth of verse, writing hundreds of original songs, as well as collecting, amending and preserving many other Scottish folk songs. Burns died at the age of 37. It was thought that he had a heart condition, exacerbated by years of hard labour in the fields. 10,000 people attended his funeral, and this was in the days before there was social media to spread the word quickly and widely. Burns is buried in Dumfries, but remembered every year by the Burns Suppers, which are held in his honour on or around his birthday.
What kind of poetry did Burns write? What was his style, and were there any themes he followed?
As I mentioned, Burns had an eye for the ladies, and a lot of his work was romantic and inspired by the women in his life. He also celebrated Scottish culture, song, whiskey, haggis, for example. But Burns was also a bit of a radical. He was aware of both the American and French revolutions, which happened during his lifetime, and this influenced his writing. He did appear to be clever enough to address such themes of oppression and injustice, and to satirise figures of authority in a subtle manner, so as not to bring too much heat upon himself or his ever-expanding family. Burns wrote work in English, Scottish, and in the Scots dialect of English. BBC Scotland has a magnificent collection of Burns's work recited by various actors, politicians, and even members of the royal family. It's well worth listening to, and we will play an excerpt very shortly.
Yeah, we heard the examples of his poetry at the Burns Supper. Let's focus more on the now. It was the first time either of us had attended such an event. I had a great evening.
Me too. Burns Suppers are held all over the world. You would think that the most authentic suppers would be held in the various Burns clubs across Scotland, but given that they're usually hosted elsewhere by Scottish expats, and the format of the event hasn't changed in over 200 years, wherever you celebrate, you'll probably experience the real thing. We were lucky that we were able to attend an affordable supper at a local church, and you wouldn't have guessed that we were hundreds of miles from Burns's birthplace. The evening began with the Selkirk Grace, so named because Burns was alleged to have delivered it before dinner with the Earl of Selkirk. This is followed by the haggis, the main component of the dinner, being brought into the hall with the accompaniment of the bagpipes that we heard earlier. A speaker then recites Burns's address to a haggis, and you're now going to hear an excerpt of that poem recorded by the BBC.
Fair for your honest sonsy face, great chieftain o' the puddin' race, abon the ma ye tak your place, pain, stripe or therm, weel are ye worthy o' a grace, as lang's my arm. The groaning trencher there ye fill, your hurdies like a distant hill, your pin would help to mend a mill in time o' need, while through your pores the dews distill like amber bead. His knife, see rustic labour dicht, and cut you up wi' ready slicht, trenching your gushing entrails bricht like ony ditch. And then, oh, what a glorious sicht, warm, reeking rich.
So those are the first three verses of the address, of which there are eight verses in total, read by the Scottish actor John Gordon Sinclair. As you can hear, it's in the Scots dialect, and even for English speakers, it's difficult to immediately decipher it. But on the evening, it's performed with some theatricality, and one can easily catch the gist. Namely that the haggis is the greatest of all foods, better than anything that can be found in other countries, and it'll make those who partake of it big and strong. There then follows a toast to the haggis, with everyone in attendance raising their glasses of either whiskey, wine or ale in salute.
Dinner is then served. Usually they are chicken and leek soup, but we went straight into the main course of haggis, nibs and tatties.
For those of you who are unfamiliar, I'll explain exactly what this is. I need hardly inform you of haggis, for it's well known that this is a smallish four-legged wild animal which roams around the mountainous Scottish terrain. To enable it to negotiate the hilly landscape more easily, the animal has longer legs on one side of its body than the other, although this means it can only run in one direction. These are hunted extensively each new year and are served boiled at a Burns supper. Haggis are also used in sporting events. The World Haggis Hurling Championships also take place each year on Burns's birthday. Getting back on track, tatties are easy, straightforward mashed potatoes. And as for neeps, well, I've done my research in this and now I'm totally confused. I thought it was mashed turnip, but it seems that people from different parts of the UK are completely divided over what a turnip is, and neeps may actually be Swedes. Anyway, again, these are boiled and mashed, and served up as a simple yet delicious 3-item main course.
Indeed, there are plenty of people going back for a second helping.
Including me, but that's not a surprise. Anyway, after dessert, there's usually a bit of entertainment, either a performance of a Burns song or a recital of one of his longer poems. Then it's on to the main speech of the night, which, being in honour of Burns' immortal memory, is a little more serious in tone, though not without moments of levity. It's here that all attending will be reminded of Burns' life, times and achievements, and why these are still relevant to us today. Through the speech that was delivered at the event we attended, we learnt that there are 50 statues of Burns outside of the UK, mostly in English-speaking countries admittedly, but testament to his influence across the globe. We also learnt about that radical streak we referred to earlier, and how he would lampoon politicians and bemoan the situations of those at the lower end of the class spectrum. And if that's not relevant today, then I don't know what is. The speaker interspersed the narrative with personal recollections and with excerpts from Burns's work, and it definitely achieved its aim of educating and informing us about the type of person he was and why he's still held in such high regard today.
Then we had a toast to the lassies.
And then the reply on behalf of the lassies. These are rather more light-hearted in tone, exploring the often fraught relationships between men and women. And there's plenty of laughs to be had here, as there were afterwards when we attempted some Scottish dancing for the first time. I'm not really one for busting out the moves on the dance floor, so this was the bit of the evening that I was least looking forward to. But I have to say, our fellow guests were really supportive, talking us through what we needed to do and reassuring us that if we got it all wrong, it wouldn't matter anyway. And while some of the steps seem straightforward at first glance, the fact that the dances last more than 5 minutes meant that my concentration had waned and invariably things didn't go quite as they should. But it didn't break anyone's leg and nobody seemed to mind about my rubbish dancing. Maybe we'll get a bit of practice in before next year though.
Before we went home, everyone joined together to sing Auld Lang Syne, another of Burns' verses that is well known around the world.
Okay, let's have a look back at our visit to the Sky Garden at the top of 20 Fenchurch Street.
Or the Rocky Turkey Building, as it's also known.
Yeah, quite a few of the buildings that have sprung up in London over the last few years have been given nicknames. Most famously, there's the Gherkin, real name 30 St Mary Axe, the Cheese Grater, or the Leaden Hall Building to be proper, the Razor in Elephant and Castle, also known as Strata. Even Big Ben is an unofficial title. We could mention the nickname for the City Hall building, but this is a family show.
Anyhow, 20 Fenchurch Street was designed by Raphael Vignoli, an architect from Uruguay.
And the building was opened in 2014. It has 34 stories of office space, and it's designed in such a way that the upper floors, where the rents are higher, have a larger floor space. This makes the design somewhat top-heavy. The curved windows also caused problems during the summer in 2013 as it was being constructed. They reflected the sun's rays to the streets below at such a temperature that they caused the bodywork of a car to melt and a doormat outside a nearby shop to catch fire. An awning has since been installed near the summit of the south side of the building to prevent such issues in the future.
I don't think Vignoli expected it to be so sunny in London.
Right. Anyway, you can visit the Sky Garden on the 35th floor for free, though you do have to book in advance. We headed up there at about 10:30 in the morning and had been looking around happily for 10 minutes when...
the fire alarm went off.
Yep. Now, I don't know if it's the same in the rest of the world, but here in the UK there's a dangerously lackadaisical response to such alarms. Everyone just looks around expecting a further announcement that it's a false alarm. That didn't materialise on this occasion, and we were told to make our way down to the ground floor. Of course, it wasn't possible to use the lifts, so we got to see every single floor as we took a 15-minute walk down the stairs. I'd obviously rather walk down than up, but our calves were aching the next day.
Fortunately, we were able to return later and get another look at the place.
The building and the Sky Garden in particular have come in for some criticism. The plans for the garden were far more expansive than what's actually been incorporated. There's less greenery than many expected, and the garden, if you can even call it that, is far less prominent than the bars and restaurants up there. This is a major disappointment to some, and it has been pointed out that it's not really a public garden as advertised. You can't just walk in off the street. You do need to make a reservation, go through a fair bit of security, and I have been told, although it wasn't our experience, that you can't stay there for any more than 90 minutes at a time. On the positive side, the views are magnificent, and we were lucky that when we returned after the fire alarm, the sun had broken through the clouds, the morning mists had disappeared, and we were able to see numerous famous London landmarks on the horizon. Everything from the nearby Shard to the Tower of London, the BT Tower and Wembley Stadium beyond that, St Paul's still dominating the London skyline after so many years, Canary Wharf as well, and numerous other recognisable buildings.
What's more, the roof is also covered by windows. So when the weather is good, not only can you see the view out and down, but you can also look up at the amazing sky. During our visit, we also saw the window cleaners on the skyline. They worked on the windows very naturally, but it gave me goosebumps. It's amazing that there is no technology for cleaning windows to replace manpower, and I respected them for their bravery. Finally, it was funny that the staff at the bar had to wear sunglasses because the sunshine was so strong. The bar is heading to the south, so the staff couldn't avoid the direct sunlight.
You pretty much enter that bar slash cafe as soon as you get out of the lift. The prices aren't too bad actually, and it might be nice to sit there with a coffee and have a chat while watching the seagulls swoop by. There are a couple of restaurants up there too, as I said, but I can't imagine that they cater to those on a tight budget. As mentioned, I enjoyed the views, and I'd certainly recommend the visit to tourists who want to look down on London without having to fork out for tickets to the London Eye or the Shard. And that's probably the audience that the Sky Garden are relying upon. Single visit guests are willing to jump through a few hoops for a great viewing experience. Just don't expect to be overwhelmed by the garden.
Okay, we'll finish there for now. We hope you can join us again next week. We are going to Whitechapel, home of Jack the Ripper, and we'll be telling you more about our local area in Southeast London. See you then.
See you then.